Hello, everyone, and good evening, and welcome to Marty Oakley TS Radio, Voices Carry for Animals, number 138 and counting, on Blog Talk Radio. Voices Carry for Animals is coming live from the PPJ Gazette Online, and if you please, if you want to visit it, you can go to www.ppjg.com. .me, and then you can at the bottom of the article you'll see places where you to share to the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, Press More, Google, and WordPress, and the list is there. But I just want to go over a couple things. I want to welcome aboard all you new listeners out there, because we're having another great show tonight. We've had a lot of amazing guests over the years, several years, and we're going to keep going stronger, because we are the animals' voices and we must be heard. You know, all animals deserve a chance. If all humans out there would just give them a chance and just feel the bond, it is amazing, because you know they suffer just like we do, and they just speak out another language. You know, they can see and eat and hear and walk and just everything that we do, and they can suffer just like we can. So we got to be there for their needs, because they can't call up for help and go to the doctors by themselves, or if they're hurt so bad from being injured or hungry, or it's terrible. So we all have a lot of us have pets in our own homes out there, but there's pets out there that are getting abused and neglected seriously, and there's no excuse for it. We have to be their voices. You know, don't turn your head if you see animal cruelty, elder abuse, child abuse. Please report it and be their voices, because without us, they have no hope to carry on. I just wanted to go over a couple things. Today is my father's 9th anniversary of his death, and I wanted to give a tribute to him and wish him, tell him that I miss him here very dearly, and I think about him each and every day. And just a short phrase of what happened is, back in 2008, he ran away, and he had went into, they Baker Acted him, and they kept him for 100. They're supposed to only keep him for 120 days for evaluation and return home. Well, he never made it home, and this case has went on for many, many years. And he was severely neglected in a nursing home back in 2008. We had the family. We stuck together like we all have our whole life. We demanded him out of there, and because we were so angry, frustrated, we were flabbergasted, we were, totally devastated what we went through. But in the second nursing home, they had reported that he had bed sores stage 4 down to the bone, and I've seen him, and I was shaking so bad I was crying, and my mother, I thought, was going to have a nervous breakdown. And this is not the only thing. He was dehydrated, malnutrition, lost 32 pounds in 8 weeks. Both rotary caps were turned on both of them, where they had dropped them and notified the family 4 days later. He had decubitus ulcers on the bottom of both of his heels. They were devastating. And that's where they put the shoes, size 8 when he wore a 10. And when he got to the hospital in his last days, they wanted to amputate both feet. I mean, this list is horrific. It's uncalled for. It's totally unacceptable. My mother, she had won the wrongful death suit back in November of 2012. And then the nursing home appealed 3 times and lost on the punitive damages. And ladies and gentlemen, the punitive damage, we're talking about, a human being in a nursing home that got abused and neglected, which turned into a total nightmare for everybody. They turned around, and the state of Florida mandated my mother to pay 50% of the punitive damages to help improve the quality of care in nursing homes. We did not get charged with wrongful death. They did. So why should we have to pay for their deadly mistakes? And to this day, I'm fighting 2 years in a row over that. I feel like I'm spinning my wheels because these politicians are turning away. They're ignoring it. They don't seem interested, and I don't know why. But I'm going to keep going until somebody listens to us, because this is not only for my father. It's all for the residents out there. So everyone, please, if you can, I'm going to be fighting till the day I die out there if I have to, because he deserves total justice. He deserves recognition. He was a wonderful father, husband, uncle, grandpa, brother, wrestler. I mean, he was an ex-former pro wrestler from WWF for 32 years. He started back in the late 50s up to the early 80s, which led into WWE, which is humongous today. He loved his family, his friends, and you know, all the fans that he had. So I just want to, I got a petition on causes.com. If you haven't already seen the petition, please go there and please spread the word. We need better care in a lot of these nursing homes. And not all of them are bad. I'm not saying all nursing homes are bad, but I have a lot of nurses that are supporting me. The one who helped me with the petition, and she says she knows all about it, the short staffing, underpaid, you know, overworked, and short staffing leads to neglect and abuse. So she didn't want her name mentioned, which I can understand because she might get fired. But I thank her for helping with this petition. It's on www.causes.com, and it's under Chief White Owl's Law, stiffer laws and harsher penalties for nursing homes. I looked at it today. There's 10,205 members, and there's 9,281 signatures. I think we could do a lot better than that. You know, just get the word out there, the awareness, the prevention, because there's a lot of greed going on out there, and it needs to be stopped, the profit before people. And also on Facebook, there is the Chief White Owl Pro Wrestling Legend. Got a tribute page for him there. And if you guys would please, all of you would check it out, press like and share too, because he deserves this recognition, because, you know, we can't bring him back. We only wish, but this is for all of us in our futures, because we never know when, if we're going to end up in a nursing home or some kind of assisted living or whatever. We don't know what our futures, but we need to pay attention and open our eyes more, because there's a lot going on out there where it's a lot of profit going before people, and it's a no-no. There's another one I wanted to bring up. I told Sam Wincup, and another thing, thank you, everybody, and I hope you do sign the petition and help me out, because we got this big fight other, you know, went all the way for the wrongful death, but there's a fight still going on for the punitive damages. So hopefully to update you with some good news soon. Rest in peace, Dad. I love you very much. And I'll always be fighting for you. You're so well worth it. And rest in peace until we meet again in eternity. But I wanted to bring up Sam Wincup. She was a former guest on here from Lucy's Edmonton Advocates Project, and it's on Facebook. Lucy has been in a zoo up there in Canada for 40 years, and she's been getting abused and neglected and everything out in the cold. So if you guys could please go to Lucy's Edmonton Advocates Project and press like and share. There's a new video out that a lot of groups have participated in, Save Nosy Now. There's another issue that they won't, you know, let her go, you know, let her retire to a sanctuary. But Sam Wincup is the vice president at Lucy's Edmonton Advocates Project. So please do that. I want to give a big thank you for A Voice for Animals on Twitter, Shauna Walters, for promoting this show every week. Voice for Animals on Facebook, the Paul's Call Show, Voices Care for Animal Support Group, and also Fans of Animal Rights, also with a Paws in the Law on Facebook. Thank you all for your continuous support of helping me promote these shows every week. You're awesome. So everyone, if you play back these archive shows, you can catch them, and because they're all archived every Tuesday night, and you can listen 24/7. So, and the chat room is open. It is if you sign in from the sign in from Blog Talk Radio, you can sign in from Twitter or Facebook, and so go past the comment or go past the comments, and the chat room will appear. You're more than welcome to come on board in there. So we'll go ahead and get with the show, and we got two amazing guests. One's a returning guest, and I'm going to bring her on. It's Watchdog Mary, and she's been on here several times, and I'm always welcoming her back. Watchdog Mary, I want to welcome you back to A Voices Care for Animals, number 138. How are you this evening?
I'm well, Debbie. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm hanging in there, you know, trying to do my best and help, you know, all the ones out there in need. So, but I wanted to welcome you back again because this is such an honor again. And like I would tell you, I'm Pitbull Debbie, you know. But anyway, you want to go ahead and just refresh the audience of, you know, how you got started, and we'll go with Dr. Ellen Jefferson next. Go right ahead.
Oh, sure. So I am an award-winning investigative journalist who is writing about animal issues now, and I have a Facebook page, Watchdog Mary, and then I have a website, which is watchdogmary.com, and I also started writing recently for The Dodo, which is a big, amazing website and Facebook page that is all about the animals, and it's just wonderful. And we're going to be talking about how to make your local shelter a no-kill facility. And we have one of the leading experts in the country on about that topic tonight with us, which is Dr. Ellen Jefferson from Austin Pets Alive. Is she on the phone line too?
I can bring her on right now. Dr. Ellen Jefferson, welcome aboard the Voices Care for Animals. How are you this evening? 138.
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're so very welcome.
I'm doing well.
And so
and
thanks for all you're doing. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The first thing that we should talk about is if you think right now, everyone who's listening, how is my local shelter doing with animal control? Do most of you out there have the answer? Do you know? Do you know how many dogs or cats are taken in every year by your local animal control? And do you know the disposition of what's happened to all those dogs and cats and animals? And all of this should be public record, and people should just ask the question, I wonder how my local community is doing? And if you want to find the answer to that, all you have to do is call your city or town or even county's animal control and ask them, you know, who's in charge, and then tell them you want to make a public records request. And every state has different laws about this, but it's all basically the same. And you want to make a request, and you don't have to be an attorney to make this. You don't have to be a journalist to make this. You want to make a public records request, and you want to ask how many dogs were taken in last year, how many cats were taken in last year. And then you want to have them tell you the disposition of every single animal. So in terms of dogs and cats in, and when we talk about dogs and cats out, where did they go? Did those dogs and cats go to a rescue group? Did they go to a foster home, to an adoptive home? Were they returned to their owner? Or were they euthanized? And you want to see how those numbers stack up. And that's how you can kind of get a ballpark idea how your local community is doing and if they are a no-kill shelter. And I think Dr. Jefferson is the expert on how to define what no-kill is and what are reasonable kind of ballpark numbers that people might want to see in their communities.
Yes,
well,
I think everyone
too. Well, I think that it's a really complicated matter, and I think what you're talking about mostly is municipal shelters, and that's really where you're looking is the shelter that takes in the stray animals and is not is is not able to turn them away. And what that means is that they have the hardest time finding live outcomes for them, and so they're the shelters that need the most support to get the animals out alive. And finding out that data is critically important if you want to help, because oftentimes the public doesn't know that animals are dying, and unfortunately in most cities animals are dying that are going into municipal shelters. And so it is really important to understand exactly what's happening first, and I think you're right to try to get the information from the shelter first, and if that doesn't work, then you can simply go to the city and ask for the public information request. Some cities have a nonprofit that is running the open intake shelter, and the nonprofit is not legally obligated to give data out, so that makes it a much more complicated matter. But I think, at least luckily, the majority of cities use municipally run shelters to handle their animals that are roaming the streets. So as far as no-kill is concerned, there's been a push nationally to make 90% the number, the percentage of animals that leave the shelter alive. And that's 100, you know, that's using 100% of the animals coming in and 90% leaving alive. What we found here in Austin is that 90% is way too low. The city of Austin is doing an amazing job, and we're going to be joined later by Kristen Arbach from the city of Austin to talk about how they do that. But there are they are at a 98% live release rate for the animals that are coming into their shelter, which is phenomenal in a city this size. So it's doable. It's happening here every day. And my hope with a program like this is that we can help other communities. And one other thing I wanted to say, Debbie, when you were talking about your father, is that, first of all, I'm really sorry for your loss. But second of all, animal shelters are a lot like the human institutions that are out there. Specifically like nursing homes, where they're underfunded, they're overcrowded, they're forgotten. It's kind of a place where people put living creatures and forget about them because they're out of sight, out of mind. And so you're talking about an institutional change on the people front, and that's what we're trying to do on the animal front too, is we need institutional change, which is much harder than just demanding change. It is, you know, it means a total change in protocols and procedures and policies and city agendas to make it worthwhile for a city to embark on no-kill.
Mm-hmm. And you're right, too. That's a real good point, because, you know, like with my father and stuff, I can't blame them all. You never heard me say nurses are murderers, because if we have nurses that are murderers, we really got some serious issues. Because with the neglect, you know, when the short staffing comes in, that heads to abuse and neglect. So when they're short staffed, you know, the whole nine yards, it goes right into it. And there's so much of that going on out there. You know, so many one and star, you know, nursing homes. That's low, very low overall performance. One's low performance. They should all be 4 and 5, just like these shelters. We need, you know, no kill nursing homes, hospitals, because they're number three in the cause of death in America is preventable medical errors. You know, so what kind of, you know, what excuse do we have to just keep letting this stuff happen? We got to do something, you know, because we could all be at high risk, all of us, even our animals. So, you know, when I can't thank you enough, Dr. Jefferson, for what you're doing. And audience out there, I forgot to tell her, she's a DMV veterinarian, executive director of Austin Pets Alive. And what you're doing there, Dr. Jefferson, is outstanding. And you know what? It's a positive impact on the animals' world and all of us, you know, because they deserve a right to live just like we do and have their rights. Because
that's right. And
go ahead. They're awesome.
I was just going to say, and we have the tools to save them. And so there's no reason. We know what it takes to save them. It's just a matter of getting the people empowered and motivated and mobilized to do it. And so we're slowly seeing change across the country. Fewer animals are dying than they used to be, but it's still millions a year. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but it's, you know, if we can, if everybody listening today can do one thing to save animals starting tomorrow and keep adding to that list of things that they're doing to save animals in the shelter, then eventually every community is going to be no-kill.
And if someone listens to this show and they think, If someone's listening to this show and they think, oh my gosh, I know my community is a mess. How can we even start? How can we even, nobody cares in my town. What would you recommend people do?
Well, I personally recommend starting with the Olive Branch and going into the municipal shelter and trying to find a way to work with the management there to come up with programs. They could be volunteer programs. They could be fundraising programs, foster programs, ways that, that community members can help get some of the heavy lifting done. If the shelter is underfunded, which most of them are, then it's not necessarily that they don't want to have a great foster program or do a lot of marketing for adoption. It could simply be they just don't have the resources. So I think the very first step is to go in and offer to help and say, you know, I've got a marketing background. I can come help take photos of the dogs and cats and get them out online. I can start a Facebook page for the shelter, or maybe get some articles in the newspaper about the great work that's happening at the shelter. There's lots of ways that, that average citizens can go and help in the shelter setting. Now, there's always the possibility that you'll be turned away, and certainly that's happened at the, in the different ways that I've tried to help in the past. And then you have to make decisions on how you want to proceed if you want to try to be a, the hammer with the media and talking about what's happening and why it's wrong, or if you want to continue trying to make inroads with personal connections at the shelter. And I think that every community is different. What we did here in Austin is we created Austin Pets Alive so that we could basically start a whole organization that would simply take the animals from the municipal shelter and find them homes. And that was kind of a mix between the two methodologies because it didn't require the city to allow us to do much other than take the animals, and it didn't require a lot of, you know, trying to force the city through the city council to do it. A little bit of that, but mostly it was just creating a new entity.
And with Austin Vets Alive and the city working so closely with you, you really made great strides. Now you're at a 90% no-kill rate, meaning that 98% of the animals that come in are leave alive, and the ones that don't make it out for whatever reason, they might be in horrible shape health-wise, they might be in terrible shape, or they might have been incredibly aggressive and were deemed that they were unable to be rehabilitated. But the APA, Austin Pets Alive, and the city work together to try your best to make sure that every animal has a good, positive outcome.
That's right. And that's something that we've cultivated that relationship over the last 8 or 9 years. And so it didn't start out that way. It started out as being more combative. And frankly, we weren't very welcomed. But I think now we're at a place where we work very well together. And where they need help, we try to step in. And where we need help, they try to step in. And so it's a real partnership, public-private partnership. But that hasn't always been the way. And I think it's very hard to get to that point. I hope, and that's what I mean about the institutions like the nursing homes, is we have to see institutional change before we can expect every community to have that kind of public-private relationship that is super positive. It took a long time for us to get there.
And Austin is kind of known now as a beacon in the country for being no-kill and a shelter that tries to work with the community and work with animals. What was the live release rate when you started there? And I know now it's 98%, but years ago, back when Austin was still going through this transformation into the success story it is now, what was the live release rate back then?
It was 45% in 2007, which was the year before we started.
Wow, so that meant that only 45% of the animals that came in left the shelter alive.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I know. It was disturbing, to say the least.
And what if somebody, what would you say, if they get pushback from their city? I've talked to shelter volunteers who've come to me and said, the shelter says the volunteers aren't allowed in, and if people start talking about what's going on there, they're just going to kill all the animals.
Well, that is really hard, and that I know of situations where that has happened. I think that, you know, again, you have to kind of choose which angle you want to go from. It's not possible to be the change agent utilizing all the tools. Like, it wasn't possible for us as Austin Pets Alive to be working with the city to take the animals in and also trying to bash them. That wouldn't work. So if you're the rabble-rouser out in the community and you feel like your job is to expose what's happening at the shelter, then you shouldn't expect to be welcomed with open arms as a volunteer or as a partner. But I think that there's a need for all the different voices. And it is trying to figure out which one is the right lever to pull, because every city is going to be different. And honestly, you know, I don't want to sound dismissive of people's feelings, but this is animals' lives that we're talking about. And I do feel like it is important that city councils know what's happening and know that the community is unhappy about it. If they can't make any headway with the people that have the power to make the change at the direct shelter level, if that's not working, then the city council needs to know. Everybody in a city structure or county structure is there because of the will of the people. And so people need to raise their voice, and politicians will listen. And the politicians are the ones that set the policy that the staff follows. So I really can't undervalue what politics mean in this movement, because it's all about change, and that change doesn't happen. Change doesn't usually happen when everything's going well. When politicians feel like things are happening great and they're going great, they don't typically make massive changes. So it's usually when they hear from their constituents and their voters that, hey, we're really unhappy about this and something needs to change, and it might be you in office that needs to change, then they start listening and they're like, okay, well, I actually want to help on this. I care about animals too. And we all want to have a better city. So that was kind of a long-winded answer, but I think that it's important to pick which way you want to go. It's hard to fill all the roles at once.
Got it. And then maybe something when Kristen Auerbach from the City of Austin Animal Control calls in here in a moment. Debbie, I think she's going to be on the line shortly. What's really fascinating, too, is the economics of it. And if a city says to a volunteer or to a group of people who care about these animals, you know, we'd really love to go no kill and we'd really love to help more, but we just can't afford it. And from what I understand, there are ways to make no kill economically viable.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a couple of things that are important in there. One is that you can work with another organization, like a nonprofit, to raise funds. That can be a Friends of organization. There's plenty of organizations that support municipal shelters, and the way they support them is by providing volunteers and fundraising. And so that provides extra money. If the city's not willing to spend that money on the shelter, you can get it through donations through the community. The other thing that I would say is that the person who's just leaving the role of Austin Animal Center's chief director is she likes to say that the city would never say, well, we can't afford to have a fire department that can go to the second floor to save everybody in a burning building. And it really, a city really needs to be striving for being the best and doing what's right, not trying to nickel and dime it on life and death decisions. Of course, there are going to be restrictions, and you may not have the fanciest equipment in the world, but there shouldn't ever be a question about whether animals live or die, or that we are delivering a substandard service to the community because we just can't afford it. There's really not any other departments where counties or cities would say have that as an argument as to why they should keep killing animals. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yes. And Watchdog Mayor Dr. Jefferson, we got a caller calling in from area code 512. And do you have any comments or questions for the guests, please? And try to refrain from any noises in the background, TVs, radios, conversations. You're more welcome to come aboard. Welcome to Voices Care for Animals, number 138. How are you doing this evening? Go right ahead. You're live and on air.
Hi there. This is Kristen Auerbach from Austin Animal Center calling in.
Hey, welcome aboard.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I've been listening to your conversation, and I'm really excited to be here talking with Dr. Jefferson and all of you, so thank you. I remember when I first heard about Austin, I heard that in 2006, 15,000 animals were dying in the city every year. And I'm proud to say that I got to join this team at Austin Animal Center 2 years ago, and with the help of Austin Pets Alive, we euthanized fewer than 500 animals last year. So we went from 15,000 animals a year dying to about 400. And it really has shown me the power of Dr. Jefferson's model, the Austin Pets Alive model, and the work that can be done when the municipal shelter and the nonprofit work together. So it's exciting stuff.
How do you juggle the cost of being no-kill?
Well, I think that this community has shown how much it values no-kill, and we have a generous operating budget, but we are among one of many no-kill communities, hundreds throughout the United States, and they each have different budgetary restrictions. While we have a strong operating budget, my colleague in Virginia saves 3,000 animals on a $200,000 budget with two employees. And so we've proven and shown that throughout the U.S., people are doing this with all kinds of restrictions. And for some communities, it's money. And for some, like Dr. Jefferson talks about, it's their city or county leadership that is causing challenges to no-kill. Every community has its own challenges, but we make it work because we all come from the place of having an ethic that every life matters and every animal's life in our care matters just as much as the life of the animal that is sitting by our feet at night and sleeping in bed with us. They matter just as much as our pets at home.
And what would you tell, knowing where Austin has come in a number of years from going to only having a 45% live release rate to now 98%, if someone knows that their local shelter is a problem, what would your advice be to help them affect change in their community?
Well, I think like Dr. Jefferson said, the first thing to do is to reach out to your local shelter. For many communities, they just want help. And I think there's this idea that municipal shelters are just sort of going to be resistant. And I don't think that's always true. That has not ever been true in the shelters I've worked in. And so the first thing to do is really reach out and ask how you can help. And then the other thing Dr. Jefferson talked about, which is so important, and I think you alluded to as well, is knowing the data of the shelter. It's important not just to know that animals are dying, but it's really critical to know what animals are dying so that you know the ways in which you can be helpful. To be euthanizing or to be killing all the feral cats in a community is really different than to be losing the puppies with parvo. Different approaches are needed to save each population of animals. So finding out that information is really important too, which I think you talked about a little earlier.
Yeah, I think that's critical because you don't want to be trying to force through a behavior program when everything's dying for medical reasons.
Right.
Definitely. And then I think we have another caller.
Yes, we do. Okay, everybody, you could just stay on the line, okay? Because we've got like 25 minutes left. We've got area code 410 calling in. Welcome to Marty Oakley, TS Radio, Voices Care for Animals. How are you this evening? You're live and on the air. Go right ahead. And everybody could just stay on
the
air.
Hi, everybody.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Yes. Hi. Good evening.
Good evening. Go right in.
Yes. Hi. My name's Lisa, and I wanted to bring up one point, two points actually. Earlier, you all were discussing how to obtain the records from animal control facilities, and I just want everyone to know that in the state of Texas, I can't speak for outside the state. But the state of Texas, they have what's called animal control or animal care advisory committees. and they are mandated by the state, is my understanding. And so every animal control facility has one. It's an overseeing organization. And they routinely have monthly meetings. These meetings are open to the public. And many times myself or my volunteers have gone there, and that's where we have the statistics that show how many animals were intaked, what the live release rate was, what was euthanized, the categorization, whether they were dogs, cats, vermin, et cetera, et cetera. So I just wanted you all to know that that's another place that maybe people could go, is to go to their local community, to City Hall, for example, or their county government, and say, you know, do you have an animal care advisory committee? When does it meet? And then people from the public can attend those meetings. And they're normally appointed positions. In Corpus Christi right now, there's a vacancy on the Animal Control Advisory Committee. So these are normally positions that are appointed by your city council or your county council, that kind of thing. So that's another way people could even get involved, is becoming part of the animal care advisory committees that are throughout the state of Texas. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up is that the biggest problem, and I'm in four different shelters in South Texas, and we're doing a wonderful job. One had a 98% kill rate when we started volunteering, and now they have a 98% live release rate. So we're doing a really good job in these shelters on many levels. But the problem still exists because we're constantly reminded of it. Even the larger facilities like Corpus Christi, they always want to make sure to express to us, we are animal control. And that's where the disconnect is, because that's where they mentally shut down. And when you think you're on the right track and everything's moving forward, they remind you all the time, we're animal control. We are not a humane society. We are not a no-kill facility. They've got that mentality that they were established for 50 or 60 years ago, and that is to protect the public's safety. And many of these facilities are under the supervision of either the health department and or the police departments, in some case both. So they have a law enforcement almost mentality to it. That's the trick, is to get through to that type of mentality and get them to understand that it's got to be a change throughout the entire system, and getting your city and county council people on board and getting them to support that concept. That's really what it's going to take to affect change in a lot of these smaller communities.
In order to see change, yes, you got to take action, that's for sure. Yes. Go right ahead.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Mary, by the way.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I actually, my call dropped out during the when you called in, so I had to call back in. I wanted to make sure I was in. So, Lisa, you kind of single-handedly really decided that you uncovered the problem in these shelters down in Nueces County, in Corpus Christi, in Kingsville, and you got the numbers, and you've kind of been a one-woman show down there going to these shelters and working with them tirelessly, and you've gotten results.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say one-woman show. There's an enormous team of volunteers, and we all do work together. It's quite a team. Because so much of it, and what was said earlier is so true, we went in a very amicable way. We are here to help. What can we do to help? We didn't go in any kind of an adversarial capacity. And even so, there's always a certain degree of trepidation. But we managed to cultivate some relationships, and then we built on a lot of successes. And in certain cases, there was distinct turnarounds where an animal control facility had been accustomed to constant euthanization, and then the next thing you know, they weren't having to kill dogs or cats with the, you know, degree to which they had been. And it was as if something lifted. There, you know, it took away a tremendous burden from them. And when they started to feel better about themselves and the job and the facilities, they in turn started to support us.
If I can jump in, this is Kristen, and I think that it's really interesting to hear you talk, because I've spent my animal welfare career all in municipal shelters, and I'll tell you, there's a the role of the advocate is critically important. Even in a shelter like ours, where we're saving 98% of the animals, the role of the advocate, whether it's, I think in moments it's hostile and in moments it's friendly, right? That changes, and it depends on the organization and the place they're at. But the role of people like you who are going in and offering help and also saying you have a higher expectation for life-saving is really important. Many people in shelters are working so hard, so fast, and in many cases, all 20 years ago in animal welfare, people thought all they could do was just kill animals. You know, it was like a factory, and it was an assembly line. And so the advocate also has a role to educate animal welfare workers about what the new expectations are in that. And so I think that your approach, while you talk about being, you know, friendly with the shelters and offering help, is exactly right, but also being strong when you need to and laying out that expectation.
Exactly. And we've had a lot of success, but we have a long way to go. I mean, some of the things that were discussed in the beginning of the program, I mean, we really do need to get much more support from the city and county government structures, because until they embrace the entire idea of going more towards no kill, meaning 90% or greater consistently, then there isn't going to be any change in that director's chair. Those directors are still of that mindset that they are there to round up stray dogs. And they always remind us in Corpus Christi, they are actually run by the police department, and their mandate is to protect the public safety, and they view stray animals on the street as a public safety and health hazard. So with that kind of mentality, we do kind of need to break those barriers. But what's interesting now is these shelters are calling myself and my team of volunteers, and they're asking us for help, and they're reaching out to us. And so that has developed probably within the last year, where they're really starting to come to us much, much more so than they had in the past. And we've had some rogue volunteers, people that did kind of get a little bit adversarial. And, you know, in the end, it wasn't helpful, and it set our efforts back a tremendous amount. So it's super important to sometimes take a step back and always be of the mindset, we're here to help. What can we do to make things better? And we understand that your agenda may not be our agenda, but can we meet somewhere in the middle? And I think that's what has made our work here successful.
And one of the things that I understand that they've done in Austin and you've done in Corpus is that when the shelter comes to you and says, okay, you know what, you want to help us, we need your help, is that you all branched out and got in touch with dozens of rescue groups and dozens of people who might be open to fostering dogs, that you had to really work on communication and telling rescue groups and fosters and adopters, there are animals in need here, and we need your help.
Correct.
Ladies, so I'm picking up some background sound of a screeching. It could be a cell phone, so if you could please talk more clearly into your phone, so the because Blog Talk Radio picks up everything. All sounds. If you could do that for me, please, because there's a screeching in the background that I'm picking up. Okay, go right ahead. Sorry about that, Watchdog Mary. I'm hearing it again.
Oh, wait.
Hold on.
Hold on. I'm making sure it's got my phone.
Yeah, because I want your voices coming loud and clear. Let our voices be heard. You know,
sure. I was just saying that a lot of what Lisa's done in Nueces County and Corpus Christi, and I think a lot of what Austin's done, is they started networking like crazy. And maybe you can kind of tell us about that, is that you made sure you got the word out to rescue groups, to adopters, you started foster programs, that you made the community and rescue groups and adopters and fosters realize, hey, we need help.
Yes, we've had a lot of that. That's been a big, big part of the program here, and it's been a catch-22 because in order to get that word out, we've had to, in many cases, use a sense of urgency about the posts, and the shelters were very much against that type of thing until they realized it sometimes takes those sense of urgency posts indicating there are going to be dogs euthanized, and this is when it's going to happen. And when they realize that sometimes having that deadline information does make that difference, they've even softened up on allowing us to publish that, and as a result, we got approval from Corpus Christi Animal Control now to actually not only obtain a published euthanasia list twice a week, but publish it on social media. So that was a big step. They were afraid of the blowback from that. And I think it's been, you know, there has been some, but what they've seen is a higher live release rate by actually putting that information out there and making it a sense of urgency that these dogs have a certain deadline and need to get them out.
Yeah, I think that's really important, too. The awareness, it cannot be underestimated. I would say that it was harder, at least in Austin, it was harder than it sounds just as you're talking about it, in the sense that it wasn't – we ended up having to create a whole new force of people wanting to help, because what we found is that the rescue groups and other shelters were already at their limit for the number of animals they could take. So when we started trying to get the rest of the animals out of the shelter, they were kind of like, we're already doing as much as we can. And so – We were absolutely working with the community and trying to get more fosters signed up, get people coming to adopt, getting volunteers. But it turned into a lot more of a community awareness as opposed to animal welfare awareness. And I think that's really important because as animal welfare people, we tend to exclude the public from what we're doing because of traditional ideas that there's only so many people competent to take care of animals. And what we found is that's absolutely not true, that the average citizen can be part of the solution. And we actually need as many people helping as there are people not helping and creating problems. We need more people helping to get the animals out alive. And you can't do that with a very small team of people. You can't do that with one group. You can't do that alone. You have to empower people to be part of the solution.
And getting the word out in social media has really made a difference. I know it does with Corpus and Nueces, and I know in San Antonio, which I know APA works with, and they have San Antonio Pets Alive, they're very upfront about their posts. You know, this dog is going to be euthanized Tuesday at 5 o'clock. And people can share the heck out of those posts. I mean, how valuable is getting out on social media for these dogs and cats?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, we did encounter a lot of resistance there with that methodology for the same reasons that Lisa mentioned. And I think over time it's become not more palatable, but I definitely think that there's there's not as much pushback because the animals do make it out. A lot of them make it out alive. But it is very hard for a shelter that has been doing that work all along of sheltering and then adopting some and euthanizing some to start blasting out what they're doing, because usually they've been beaten up by the public for the last 10 years. And so putting that out there on social media is very scary, but I think it's necessary. Because the public has to know what's happening in order for them to want to act.
Yeah, I've talked to some people who they work with local shelters and say, you better not say this is X or Y city or town. We don't want the blowback from that. And you know, there's some people that go into shelters and take the pictures and share them on just private Facebook groups just because they're going to get kicked out of the shelter if the shelter finds out they're posting that on social media.
Right. Yeah, that's very common. Sorry, Kristen.
I mean, there's certainly been volunteers and shelters have certain rights to speak up, which, you know, Nathan Winograd, the No Kill Advocacy Center, talks about all the time. I think part of the key to why Austin is successful is that the word transparency isn't exactly right, but we're committed to communicating as openly with the public as we do internally. And so when we're struggling, we let the community know that. And I'll give you one quick example. Last year we had a flood and we had 60 dogs that had to be moved out of one of our locations. And they were 60 big blocky headed dogs that had been in our shelter for several weeks to more than a month, and they were living in standing crates in what is like our training room. And so we said to the community, look, we have nowhere to put these dogs, and we need your help. The location they were at is flooded, and we need emergency fosters. And a lot of shelters would be afraid to do that, understandably. But what we found is we had an outpouring of people that came and wanted to help. And within about 3 hours, every single one of those 60 dogs, those big energetic dogs, was in a foster home. Every single one. And not one dog had to spend the night in a crate. And I think that we in animal welfare are only starting to understand not just that we should be transparent because it's the right thing to do, but there's a tremendous power in asking the community for help and telling them what you're struggling with. And in the end, they respect you and your organization much more when you do.
So you're kind of saying that if people, if a community or people in a community want to be no kill and to help the animals, that first they have to show that they care, and then they have to make the community care. And then only together, if there's some semblance of wanting to care and work together, this can be done. But it all starts with the push and someone caring about what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I think so. And yeah, if you look at what Dr. Jefferson and Ryan Clinton and a few others did here, there weren't very many of them in the beginning. You can talk more about that, Dr. Jefferson, but I think that it's also true that you don't need the whole community from the beginning.
No. It's just, every issue starts with a few people making a big deal about it. And the general, we're not alone. Animal lovers, in fact, most of the public makes up animal lovers. We're not alone. And so I think it's important that the public knows about it. And it's that balancing of trying to be politically correct, but also making sure the truth is out there. And so you don't want to harm people in the same, when you're trying to save animals, but in the same breath, you do need to speak up for the animals, even if it hurts some people's feelings, because that's the only way change happens. That's the only way, like I said before, politicians don't make change when everything's going great. And I would also recommend, just really hitting home the idea of politics. I've certainly been in situations where we've been doing all the hard work and the heavy lifting and not paying attention to politics, and then the politics would be critically important, and we would have missed the opportunity to connect with politicians. So I would say, just as hard as you're working on saving dogs and cats' lives, have a contingent of people, either another organization or separate volunteers, working really hard on establishing those relationships with city officials, because they're the ones that have the power to change. And they need to know about the issue. And the only way they'll know about it is if they care about you and the problem. And that doesn't happen just by handing them a flyer.
What else should people know if they think that, if they want to help push their community to save more animals?
Well, I mean, I'm sure all three of us have different answers, but I would say that it's important to know what they need to do to get from point A to point B. You can't go and just demand change and not have any kind of solution handy. And so I think that's why, what Kristen was saying about the data and knowing which animals are dying, you also need to know what would need to take place for those animals to survive. And that's something that we can help with. I don't know if y'all are aware that we have an American Pets Alive component and have now started a training academy with Maddie's Fund, where people can come to Austin and sometimes have all of their expenses paid and learn from Austin Animal Center and Austin Pets Alive and learn exactly how to do a parvo program, how to do big dog foster programming, how to work on politics. And those things, I mean, I didn't know any of it when I started. I would have given my right eye for a tutorial. And I think, I imagine a lot of people are in the same boat. And so I would suggest that people look around them and try to find resources, whether it's through us or through other resources that help kind of create the roadmap, because there's just nothing more frustrating to a politician for people to just be mad and not have an actual solution.
I didn't know that you had that whole training program down there now. Where could people find out more information? Is there a website that they can start?
I should have that right off the tip of my tongue, but I do have
Or what can
the,
they Google?
they can look
they
up
can go,
Go ahead.
They can go to MaddieSun.org and look up the apprenticeship programs. Even this summer, I think we have, between the two organizations, we'll be offering 5 or 6 apprenticeship opportunities for people to actually come to Austin and learn about the life-saving programs.
And Maddie's fund is generously paying for people to do that. So it pays their travel expenses. And then there's also the American Pets Alive, which is AmericanPetsAlive.org. And that's a conference in September. So it's like 3 days of really intense learning from everybody that we can find that is doing no-kill. And so if people really want to learn a lot in a very short period of time, that's a great opportunity as well.
And then I know on the No Kill Revolutions website, there's actual PDFs that you can look up that have a little bit of a guidebook and a step-by-step for how you can evaluate your community, what you can do. So that's also a resource if people are listening to this and think, I want to help.
Yes, absolutely. There's great resources there. And a lot of them are by Ryan Clinton, who is one of our speakers at our conference. And he's, I think Kristen had mentioned him, but he and Nathan have put together a lot of really great articles and papers that help guide people that can't travel.
Oh, that's terrific. That's a great resource for people to have. So I know Debbie, are we getting pretty close to the time here, or how are we doing?
Yes, we are. We're down to like 3 minutes. Been really enjoying this show and learning a lot. And you know, it takes teamwork to see any victories and make things better, because the animals so well deserve, you know, to live their lives out, because all lives matter, you know, including the animals. So whatever we can do, you know, to bring, you know, I read 5 to 7 million healthy adoptable animals get put down a year, 6 to 8 million, whatever the numbers are in America and around the world, it's astronomical and totally uncalled for. So the more we all work together and band together to do what we need to do and make these lives better and make these shelters, you know, hey, when you hear those numbers are coming down, you know a victory hit, and a lot of us come together, because when you only have a small amount of people, you're only spinning your wheels. But when you have a lot coming towards you, the faster the changes will be made, everyone. And I'm down to 2 minutes here. And the caller, your name was Kristen, right? Is that your name? Thank you for calling in. Yes, thank you. And the other caller, I did get the name, but thank you for calling in also. Thank you so much, Watchdog Mary, for what another great show tonight. And I want to see you come back soon. And you too also, Dr. Ellen Jefferson. You're welcome back also. And really enjoyed it. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I hope the audience did too. I know they did. But anyway, next week we'll have a Fight for the Innocent on. And Voices Carry for Animals is on every Tuesday live at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, 6 o'clock Mountain, and 5 o'clock Pacific. Listening worldwide, unlimited listeners. So please, everybody, all the shows are archived. So if you came in late tonight, just go to Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalk.com, and search Voices Carry for Animals. You can even, on this show tonight, search for Watchdog Mary or Dr. Ellis Jefferson or Debbie Dahmer, TS Radio, Marty Oakley. It should pop up. So I want to thank everybody tonight, and please join in. On Wednesday nights, all you horse lovers out there, is Debbie Coffey. She's a wonderful advocate for the animals. Wild Horse and Burro Radio. And that's the Wild Horse Wednesdays. Thursday nights is Marty Oakley, wonderful advocate and friend also, team player, is Whistleblowers. And on Friday is Vietnam Vets Agent Orange. And on Sunday night, she's got a new co-host coming on with her, Danny Tate. So please join with her, Elder Abuse, Guardianship Abuse, and the list goes on. So please join in her, because she's done over 800 shows and counting in 7 years. And show your support, please. And how you can find these shows is www.ppjg.me, the PPJ Gazette online. Thank you, everyone, and good night, and have a wonderful and peaceful evening. Bye-bye. May God bless you all. Good night, Dr. Ellen Jefferson and Watchdog Mary. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for having us.
Hey, anytime. Yeah. My pleasure.